farmers are experiencing 5 times more depression than the general population. And my interest in soil quality is, do the things that, you know, support soil quality also have an influence on the health of farmers?
May the Forage Be With You, a podcast brought to you by the Peace River Forage Association. Welcome to episode 6. I'm your host, Nadia Mori. In this episode, you get to listen in on the second half of my chat with Brooke Hayes, where we dive deeper into her study on how healthy soils may relate to healthy farmers. And wouldn't you agree, we all need healthy farmers in our neighborhoods. Brooke shares a great saying that you likely only need a lawyer a couple of times in your life, a doctor maybe a couple of times in a year, but you need a farmer 3 times a day to have a meal on your table. Also, if you missed the first part of our chat with Brooke, be sure to check out episode 5 as well. After the chat with Brooke, there are 2 fact sheets we will dive into from the Forage Fact Sheet Vault. Both will focus on how to make your forage stand resilient to drought and winter kill and any other curveballs the weather might throw at your perennials. With that, let's jump into the second part of my interview with Brooke Hayes. Let's round back a bit to your study. So you had this question about, does healthy soils have an impact on healthy farmers and vice versa? And so how did you approach that next?
Yeah, sure. I'd be happy to kind of walk through that a little bit more. So what I started with was this idea, as I mentioned, that soil quality is influenced by these kind of global systemic forces that are degrading soil quality and in the same turn also degrading the health of farmers and the mental health of farmers. And I just think it's worthwhile to pause here to just talk about why mental health of farmers is important and why that is of concern to me. And right now, all we have to really reference back to is pan-Canadian research. We don't have BC-specific research. So the research that I'm doing will give us a bit more granular detail on this. But what we were able to discover through some of this pan-Canadian survey is that, you know, 12% of Canadian farmers today are suffering from burnout, that 58% have anxiety, and 35% have depression. That's in 2015 to 2016, and an updated version of that survey has just gone out. So we'll be able to see if that's been influenced at all with COVID and other factors. But if we look at that 35% having depression number and compare it to the general population nationally, the general population suffers from depression about, what from what I could see, 7.5% of the general population. So we're saying that farmers are experiencing 5 times more depression than the general population. So there are some factors at play that are making farmers more susceptible to mental health challenges. And so that is really a core focus of the work. And my interest in soil quality is, do the things that, you know, support soil quality also have an influence on the health of farmers? And really, I've done that by looking at sort of decoupling these major components of farmer health, soil quality, and product quality, and looking at what are the variables that influence one or the other. And I'll get to process in terms of the methods of how we'll assess it in just a moment. But just in terms of what, when I say farmer health, what I mean is farmers' optimism and agency, their relationships within communities, and their overall sense of well-being and health. So I'm not a doctor. I'm not sort of qualified to go out and do a mental health assessment of farmers, but I can look at their optimism, their feelings of agency and resiliency in the face of climate change, the strength and number of their relationships within their communities. And that's sort of where I'm starting in terms of measuring farmer health when I say that. When I'm talking about product quality, what I'm talking about is the taste and nutritive value of that product, which of course is sort of obvious, but it's also the geographic distribution and where that product goes. And one of the things I'm curious about is whether a farmer that focuses on soil quality and a farmer that is optimistic and describes themselves as healthy has a different distribution of products. Are they selling to more local audiences? Are they selling into global supply chains? Who are they selling to? And how much of that product retains some part of the farm and the farmer when it reaches the consumer? So there's a number of factors that are obviously involved with this and with soil quality, as I've already mentioned, in terms of organic matter. And so I've got a number of variables that I'm considering as sort of in the academic world, we call them independent variables, things like yield and sales and the number and strength of relationships, the different management practices that a farmer is adopting, the organic matter levels, the biological complexity on farm, you know, what are the values that are guiding that farmer and how aligned are they with those values, sort of where they are demographically. All of those variables have relationships to each other that I'm measuring through a couple of different methods, and I'll walk through the methods just very briefly. The first method is a survey, and the survey has actually already gone out across the province, and that went out in November of 2020 and was distributed via associations all across the province. And I also did some direct outreach to some farmers, and it's a very comprehensive survey. So each respondent gave me over 600 data points. That's a lot of data. I asked them about many of those factors the variables I just outlined. So I had 122 farmers that went through the entire survey and gave me data on all of those variables, which is absolutely incredible. I'm working with over 100,000 data points already. So that's going to tell us about the connections between profitability and optimism, diversity of operations and profitability and optimism, and values alignment and relationships and distribution of products. We're going to get a lot of data about how those things relate to each other. But all of this is predicated on my key question, which is farmers' health associated with soil quality? And so the very next step will be to go out and do soil quality assessments on a subset of the surveyed farms. And given that the majority of respondents that came in were from Vancouver Island, I'll be focusing on Vancouver Island to do that soil testing. And it will be comprehensive soil testing. So I'll be doing, of course, the physical parameters like aggregation and water holding capacity and texture, chemical parameters like macronutrients and micronutrients, and, you know, obviously nitrogen, potassium, phosphorus, those sorts of aspects, carbon. But also I'll be looking at the biology of the soil. So I'm really interested to know how biologically active the soil is. And so there's a couple of methods to look at that. And also, I'm very excited. We have had a second researcher join this project. And what she'll be looking at for each of these sites is the biodiversity of the sites. So she'll be doing habitat mapping and understanding, you know, how biodiverse these sites are and whether or not that plays a role on optimism, profitability, soil carbon capture, farmer health, etc. So really excited to have that layer going in as well. And then the third thing that we'll be doing is assessing products that are coming off of these farms. So we'll be looking for a subset, again, that are growing consistent products that we'll be able to assess in a consistent way. And we'll be able to see if there's a connection between product quality and these other elements I've just mentioned. So it's a really comprehensive assessment across a variety of different topics. And it's highly likely this will turn into a full PhD project, depending on how far out this goes. But that's the plan. That's how we'll be assessing this question.
So it sounds like you have a tremendous amount of data.
Yeah.
I'm not sure at this point, you probably haven't had the opportunity to put too many pieces together because like you said, you're still missing the soil data and output of the nutritional value in terms of the product produced. So do you have any insights you can share so far?
Yeah, we do. And I'm just digging into the data. So I really only have kind of the high level cursory, big picture granular at this point, but we're just about to go into deep dive. And I'm really excited by some of the initial findings that we're seeing. So a couple of things that came out of the early research or the early data is that, you know, younger farmers are the most optimistic farmers and that optimism tends to decrease over time. So that might not be it might sort of resonate with some farmers in their own experience. A second interesting finding is that we did look into profitability. We wondered, you know, one of the first things I wondered was, do farmers that describe themselves as profitable also describe themselves as optimistic? Because that really goes to the basis of the economic policy paradigm that we've been working towards. And it does look like farmers that describe themselves as profitable do seem slightly more optimistic than those that say they struggle to remain profitable. But even profitable profitable farmers are struggling. Even those farmers that say that they're profitable are not at all optimistic. There is a portion of them that are not at all optimistic. So that tells me we need to query that assumption a little bit more. Also, I think one of the interesting things that we, well, two other interesting points. One is that we found a strong relationship for farmers that had some product identity retained. So the products leaving their farm says either the farmer's name, the farm location, or something about where it came from. Those farmers that had product identity retention said that they felt valued within their community. To me, that's really important. That speaks to kind of rural community strength and culture, and something that we haven't really queried directly before. And the other finding that I thought was really interesting is that we saw that the closer to home that products are sold, so the shorter the distance between the farm and the consumer, the more profitable farmers feel they are. So I think that kind of also resonates on a gut level, that those farmers that are well connected to their community are describing themselves as optimistic and profitable. And I'm really curious to see, as I dig deeper into the numbers and into the relationships of interest, to see what else comes out. But those are some early findings.
Very interesting. Yeah. I could see how somebody who gets to see how they're feeding a community, and on average, all of us eat 3 times a day. And how often mm-hmm. do we think about, I wonder who grew this? Like, I wonder how they're doing, or where this came from, or what they were thinking when they grew this. I think oftentimes we don't have that connection, or it's not enabled to have that connection when you just pick up the cucumber at the grocery store.
Yeah. Yeah. In fact, I think it's very much a part of our current food system. I had to do an exercise for one of the classes I was in school this term, to do a sort of a where did my food come from journal for 24 hours, just to figure out, you know, where did the food get grown? And, you know, the vast majority of what I was eating, even though I'm really careful about what I eat, where it comes from, and I care about how my food is grown, I still really struggle to figure out the source of many of the products that we grow. But what I was going to say earlier is that I think that the COVID pandemic has really, you know, emphasized and raised, amplified a discussion about local food systems and food security and being able to have access to good quality food where we live. And I really feel that that's a welcome discussion, and one that we're probably well poised in BC to talk about, because we do have such a diversity of producers. We do have such small scale operations. Well, not everywhere, but for the most part, small scale operations that might be able to pivot to more local supply chains in a different way than some of our more conventional farmers that you might see in the Midwest.
I think it's really an opportunity for sort of a rebirth of farmer appreciation and mm-hmm. and giving that value. I think maybe you can speak to that. I sense that would have to do with mental health if you feel valued by what you're contributing to society.
Yeah, well, this is so important. I think that our culture has shifted so dramatically over the last 100 years. I think it was in the 1930s, 1 in 3 people in Canada was a farmer. Now it's something like 1 in 100. And so our culture has changed dramatically in our relationship with food. And there was a huge push in sort of the Green Revolution and industrialization to basically get people off of the farm so that they didn't have to work on the farm and they could go into the city and be successful in that way. And we're living the end result of that. But what I think it's done is it's really disconnected us from our food and where it comes from, and sometimes from the communities where the food is grown. And so we've lost our sense of value of these people and these places where the food is grown, and it's out of sight, out of mind, and we have, you know, massive pressure from consumers to reduce the cost of food, which puts pressure on the back end to farmers to really reduce the cost of food. But there are hidden costs. There are costs to the environment. There are costs to the individuals that come from making that compromise. And as we gain some curiosity about where our food comes from, as we have a growing population and food security issues, I think it demands a return to valuing the people that are growing our food, and how they're growing it and the impacts on our ecosystems. One phrase that I really like is that, you know, in our lives, we hope, you know, you need a lawyer maybe once in your life, maybe twice, hopefully not very often. You need a doctor, you know, once a year, hopefully maybe less, but you need a farmer three times a day. And so our relationships with farmers right now are not based on the same cultural system from which they evolved. It has moved into a different system. And if we do want to see a change, if we want to see farmers especially rewarded for doing good things, we need to be able to communicate that they're doing good things to people who also care about that and allow them to make those choices. That means things like traceability and better marketing. It could be done quite simply with, like, you know, better branding and, you know, better relationships and communicating where our food comes from. But consumers also have to be curious and ask for it too, so that these farmers can be recognized for the good practices. So it's a complex one. I think it's cultural and social, but it's a very important part of the discussion.
Yeah, I was going to ask you if there's some steps that a farmer or a producer could take in terms of getting the word out about, hey, this is what I'm doing and this is how I'm doing and this is why I'm doing it this way, because I think there's a lot of that education that needs to happen again to the consumer, right? But like you say, it's not just on the farmer getting on their internet and putting lots of amazing posts out. It's also about the consumer showing a genuine interest in that.
Yeah, it is. And there are some great programs. I mean, the ministry has two programs that come to mind immediately. They're often oversubscribed, but are worth thinking about. One is the ByBC marketing program, which allows, it pays for farmers and producers and processors to put ByBC branding onto their products. So that's one option. And the other is traceability, so that people can, when they receive a product in the marketplace, there's a QR code that, you know, goes back to the place where that food was harvested. So I think those are two great programs that could bridge that gap a little bit. But there's lots of work to be done in this space for sure.
Definitely. I remember one time I was shopping at a grocery store in Switzerland, and on the chicken package, there was like an actual picture of the farm and the farmer standing in front of it, smiling about, you know, like, this chicken came from here. Like, I'm proud to be producing this chicken for you.
I heard that in Japan, like 30, 40 years ago, they have QR codes on all of their fish products. If you go to the market, you can pick up fish. You can find out what boat it was harvested on, where it was picked up, what time of year, you know, everything about that product. And that was decades ago. I mean, surely we can do a better job of getting our food products more recognizable to our consumers.
But you're right. It was, as far as I remember it, too, specifically in Switzerland, it was very consumer driven. Like, the consumer really cared about where the product came from, and they cared that it was local. So they wanted to know, like, where did this come from? And they wanted to have those labels right at the supermarket, right when you shop. So again, like, it's not just on the farmer, and somewhere there's going to be cost, right? Like, somebody has to pay for the tracking, somebody has to pay for that lovely label and all those beautiful things.
And most of our, you know, commodity systems are not designed for small scale local production and distribution. You know, in many cases, BC and some communities can't produce everything they need for their community. They must rely on these external, you know, transportation and distribution networks. And it can be really tricky for farmers that want to put their products into a local supply chain, you know, if they don't have the volumes or the relationships. You know, where do you start? I mean, it's just, it can be a very, if you have an established relationship with a global supplier, that can be a lot easier and provide a lot more certainty than trying to step out and find people who are willing to put your product on their shelves. So I think, and restaurants too, right? But those relationships do come if you're looking for them, but it's definitely an area where, like, if we were going to look at accelerating policies, that would be another one I would think about.
Yeah, so many pieces to the puzzle.
Yeah, I know. Like I said, it touches everything.
So if some of the producers who are, like, again, somewhere on this spectrum, and they would love to learn more about, be it regenerative agriculture or the principles or how they could help their soil, do you have some, like, go-to favorites that you would recommend?
Oh my goodness, I have so many. There are some incredible authors out there that I would highly recommend. Anything written by Gabe Brown, Joel Salatin, David Montgomery, or Mark Shepherd has an amazing book called Restoration Agriculture. There's some older volumes out there that are also really interesting, like Masanobu Fukuoka, One Straw Revolution. You've got Permanent Agriculture with Bill Mollison. There are some amazing organizations out there that are leading the way in terms of, you know, doing long-term research studies, as well as doing education around how to adopt these kind of soil quality regenerative agriculture principles. I already mentioned the Rodale Institute, but also Regeneration Canada has a lot of resources, the Soil Society of America, the Soil Health Institute, the Savory Institute with the Holistic Management Framework for Regenerative Agriculture, the Land Institute, Soil Food Web, Integrity Soils. There's just so many resources out there. And I think, again, this is where it can be a bit overwhelming because there are so many resources out there and they don't always speak in exactly the same language. So, you know, those would be a few starting points. If any of those resonate, you know, I can certainly provide some links to those again in the show notes so people can take a look at some of those resources.
Yeah, I think that'd be great.
They can
great.
Also look at my project website.
Yes. Yeah, let's talk about that. Like, how can people learn more about you and what's going on and follow your work, because you're far from done.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I'm just getting started. And the work, you can definitely take a look at it. You can reach me. My UVic email address is brookhayes@uvic.ca, just as it sounds. My website is, project website is on the Ecogastronomy website. So the research lab that I'm associated with is Dr. John Volpe's Ecogastronomy Lab in the School of Environmental Studies at the University of Victoria. And he's working with a number of different researchers who are looking at different aspects of regenerative agriculture and, you know, how to change our management practices. And I think that program is going to build out over time. So I've got some webinars, some past webinars on that link, as well as some links to soil resources, some amazing soil resources that are there, and some mental health resources for farmers, as well as there's a bit of a project timeline so that people can get a sense of where we're at in the project and what's coming next.
Awesome. Yes, I would definitely encourage for people to check that out and see what's coming, especially because you still have a lot of findings that'll come. And I'm sure they're going to be interesting and maybe give us some pause to think about things.
Yeah. I mean, the ultimate goal is to change the way we think about agriculture. Both it started from a policy perspective, but also individually and culturally, how we value our agricultural lands and how we support farmers to keep growing us beautiful food into the future in the face of these tremendous pressures, especially climate change.
Very true. Very true. Those were lovely closing words. Any other final thoughts or?
No, I just wanted to, you know, recognize that there are so many people out there that are curious about this. I really feel like it is a conversation that is gaining a little bit of traction and that, you know, has the opportunity to be very impactful, not just for our, you know, ecosystems and for our food systems, but also for our communities. And especially, you know, rural Canada, I think really could use some attention. And this is a great way to bring attention to some of that. So yeah, I really am grateful to be invited to a conversation. If anyone, you know, is thinking about this and has some ideas about how to connect it into existing research and existing work, I would love the opportunity to partner, you know, especially on the economic side. I really believe there's a lot of work to be done on taking these more social and environmental outcomes and connecting them back into that economic framework that I'd love to be able to work with people who are interested in that aspect of this as well. So, or individual farmers that are interested in sort of reaching out and understanding more. I'm available to talk to anyone who would like to talk about how to elevate and amplify this work.
Yeah, let's put the word out and see for more traction.
Cool. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Brooke, for taking the time to share your thoughts and share your work. I really look forward to more results from your study.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate the opportunity.
Welcome back. After that, let's shift a bit gears into the Forage Fact Sheet Vault. And today we're looking at Forage Fact Sheet number 32 and 89. The topics include nutrient management for longevity and a healthy start for drought-resistant forages. I feel like with the current weather extremes that we're experiencing, being dry and hot and having wildfires raging all around us, I felt like stand longevity and drought management would be on a lot of people's minds. Now, the Peace River Forage Association did some amazing work back in the early 2000s because drought was just as much of an issue back then. And stand longevity, including winter hardiness, are two factors of great importance to northern forage producers. And several soil nutrients play a key role in preventing both winter kill and drought resistance. There are many reasons to supplement nutrients to a forage crop. Depending on the objective that you're trying to achieve, here are some examples of how nutrients could be part of your forage management plan. Maybe you're trying to increase stand longevity, improve forage quality, increase carrying capacity, reduce alfalfa winter kill, improve soil quality, and increase yield, and forage fertility is an underlying factor to all of these. The success of fertilization and the achievement of each of these objectives is, of course, also driven by other factors, one of them being moisture. And when you're already in a drought year, that's a challenging one to mitigate. Other factors are also soil chemistry, your parent material, fertilization methods, the type of fertilizer used, cropping practices, what kind of condition the stand is in, or the health of the forage stand and its composition at the time you're adding fertility. Now, a good first step before considering any fertility program is to do a soil test. Soil tests are not that expensive to come by, and your regional agrologist or agronomist or just a good old-fashioned internet search could bring you a list of local soil testing labs that are easily accessible. Now, if you've ever applied fertilizer, you know that water is a very important factor. And if it's deficient, it will suppress the economic response of fertilization. Maybe you will still get a delayed response once the moisture comes back, but you're running a big risk of losing a lot of the fertility. There is also a relationship between organic matter in the soil and the water-holding capacity, meaning that if you have more organic matter, the soil can hold more water, which then in turn can really help you out when you're in a pinch because it's dry as a bone. Sometimes even a small difference in soil moisture can make a huge difference in your yield and how your stand will fare if the drought persists. When we're going through a dry spell, and notice I'm just trying to be optimistic here that I don't have to call it a drought, but if we're going through a dry spell, it may make sense to start thinking about irrigation and maybe if that would be a viable solution. Irrigation may pay on average 3 or 4 years out of 10 in most areas of the BC Peace. Now, mind you, those are numbers that are about 10 years old, so maybe by now it may pay 5 out of 10 years to have irrigation. Regardless, it is quite a big investment in infrastructure and equipment, and that you need to figure out on the economic side of things whether the numbers make sense for your specific operation. At this point, a more economic alternative to irrigation is still to conserve more soil moisture so that you have it present in your soil when you need it. Methods of moisture conservation include keeping longer stubble and having a higher cutting height, cutting at different heights, which can also increase the snow capture, wind breaks, which could be vegetation or snow fences, snow ridging, building up organic matter by applying manure or using cover crops or other crop choices that will help build up organic matter, minimizing tillage operations or timing the tillage operation so that you're not jeopardizing your soil organic matter and the precious soil moisture that goes with it. If after all this you do garner a bit of extra soil moisture, to maximize the benefits of having that extra moisture, you must also ensure that there are adequate nutrients, or the moisture will go unutilized. Also, proper fertilization can increase the water use efficiency of the forage plants, which means that the forage plants can produce the same amount of material with a smaller amount of water. And it also allows the forage plants to draw water from deeper in the soil profile, The result of that could show up as a healthier regrowth in the late summer or fall, which wouldn't necessarily make a difference to your one-cut system in terms of yield, but nevertheless, it would help having a healthy stand that is more resilient and that is going into winter strong so that there's less chance of winter kill. To keep a stand long-lived, also be proactive when establishing a stand. Management for stand longevity involves doing a lot of little things right, and then on top of that, getting favorable climatic conditions. Getting a stand to last as long as possible starts by getting it off on the right foot when you establish it, and then looking after it along the way. The health and productivity of a forage stand ultimately also depends on healthy and productive soils with adequate nutrients. Speaking of nutrients, manure can be more than a fertilizer. Manure is actually not just a fertilizer, it is also a soil conditioner, because manure adds organic matter, bacteria, and provides a timed release of nutrients, which works well with the ongoing requirements of growing plants in a perennial stand. It can also assist in buffering the pH in acidic soils. As a bonus, manure may also provide some trace elements depending on your mineral supplementation that you use for your livestock. Get it? Whatever you put in the livestock may come back out, maybe in your manure, which then may end up in your soil. The organic matter in manure can also provide extra water holding capacity. Remember, we talked about how having 1% more organic matter can lead to an extra water holding capacity of 90,000 liters per acre. As always, you want to also look at the economic side of things. The economics of fertilizing really depends on your operation. It also depends how you measure your success. For example, if you're a dairy producer and you improve your forage stand through fertility, you may see an immediate effect of the quality of feed by having higher quality milk. But maybe as a beef producer, you may not see that effect right away. And how are you going to measure the success of your fertilizer application? While yield of a hay crop can be relatively easy to measure, sometimes important information is lost in the details. Many producers think of their yield in terms of bales per acres, assuming that the bales are going to be the same weight because they were made by the same operator and baler. This assumption can be misleading because nothing is really ever constant. Unless you go and measure your bales, it's really hard to say if they were remaining the same weight. Also, most piece producers are using a one-cut system, and therefore the amount of regrowth that happens after the cut is not always taken into account, even though it is a really important part and should be playing into the economics of evaluating the success of a fertilizer application. Another commonly overlooked detail can be the change in feed prices. For example, in a dry year when feed prices are increasing like crazy, and it only takes a small improvement in the yield of your forage to really offset the cost of the fertilizer. But the same situation may be more difficult when feed costs are more reasonable, and it takes you a larger increase in forage hay to justify the application of the fertilizer. Other factors may be even more challenging to measure, such as how much did your fertilizer application reduce winter kill? And did you have an improvement in soil quality? Was there maybe an elevation of organic matter? And all of these things would also be important considerations that may be a little bit more tricky to put a dollar number on. To round it out, here are a couple of questions that may come up for a lot of producers and some suggested ideas on how to tackle these questions. For example, how can we increase forage stand longevity? Some of the ideas that could work on that is to focus on establishing successful stands. So having good soil fertility, quality seed, doing your good weed control, having a seed bed that's lovely prepared, and you're getting that forage stand off to a good start. To choose long-lived species and varieties and staying on top of what the latest varieties are that have been proven for stand longevity. And then if you do have shorter-lived species in your stand, let them reseed periodically. For example, sandfoin can be excellent in your stand as a non-bloat forage, but it does need to be allowed to reseed every 3 to 4 years, or else you will start losing it in your stand. Another question that may come up is, how do I reduce winter kill? Some ideas on that would be, again, watch your soil fertility. Pay attention to the timing, severity, and repeated cutting or grazing in mid-August to mid-September, because you would like to have 4 to 6 weeks before the first hard frost where the forage can start preparing for winter, meaning it does not have to worry about regrowing at that time, it just needs to focus on putting down reserves into the root. Another thing that can help is to use winter-hardy species and varieties. Again, just paying attention to what varieties are out there and asking your seed dealer for specific winter-hardy species that are more adapted to our northern climate. When we're going through freeze-thaw cycles, there could be certain frost pockets that happen in your field, and it's always that low-lying spot that seems to be frozen out. So that might be an area where you need to pay special attention to and use maybe slightly different strategies compared to the rest of your field. Finally, how can we improve drought resistance? Here some ideas are to make sure your root systems are healthy, strong, and extensive. If you have those deep roots, then the plants, even in a dry situation, can still access really deep soil moisture. Try and keep the plants as disease-free as possible so they don't have to fight on multiple fronts. When they're already being taxed by dry conditions, they really don't want to also battle with disease at the same time. Make sure nutrient levels are adequate in both soils and the plants, especially when it comes to potassium. Speaking of potassium and phosphorus may be some of the less focused on nutrients, but nevertheless, they're really important in healthy forage stands. Let's look at the role of potassium specifically. It's a relatively immobile nutrient in the soil. It is mobile in the plant. It is crucial to water relations and the osmotic pull of leaves drawing water up into the roots and into the plant. It helps with full use of soil available water to withstand drought stress. It reduces fungal and bacterial diseases, and it's important when the plant is producing seeds and filling the grain, which is when it's converting sugar to starch. What about the role of phosphorus? It too is very immobile in the soil, but also very mobile in the plant. It increases root growth and therefore allows for more extensive extraction of moisture and nutrients. Aha! Where did we hear that before? In terms of helping drought resistance. So remember your phosphorus when you're doing your fertilizer input. Phosphorus is also the energy currency in plants, as it has a role in energy storage and transfer. It encourages reproductive development and supports earlier maturing of plants. So even though we often think of nitrogen when we talk fertilization, phosphorus and potassium are also two very important nutrients. Again, none of the nutrients should be looked at in isolation. It's always about the entire package and delivering everything that the plant needs to do well. And plants that do well do better in drought stress and have a better chance of surviving winter kill and any other crazy curveballs that the weather may throw at your perennials. So let's give our forage plants the best leg up that we can, that they're as prepared as possible for whatever crazy weather may be thrown at them. And as we've seen this summer, the weather can, and sometimes really does, go crazy. Wishing you more calm weather, ideal weather for haying, and ideal weather for your livestock operations out there. Check in again next week when we have a new episode for you. If you like our podcasts, make sure to like and share. Let's spread the forage love far and wide. As always, we welcome your feedback at coordinator@peaceforage.bc.ca. Make sure to check out our website and read up on those forage fact sheets, so that your forages are drought and winter kill proof. So long, may the forage be with you.